Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello. Before we start this episode of the MMA Fan Podcast, we need to tell you about our sponsor, Freetrain. Freetrain do these fantastic running vests for you to run in, hit the bag in, and they keep your phone close to your chest. No more do you need to have your phone rumbling around in your pocket when you run or at an awkward angle on your arm. You can keep it on your chest with easy access to your phone whenever you go training. And what can the people do, Stu, if they want to get a vest?
Simple. Head over to www.freetrain.com. Have a look, see what you like. And when you pop it in the basket, just before you check out, pop in the code MMAFAN, save yourself 10%. I mean, don't ever let it be said we don't spoil you here on this podcast. www.freetrain.com. Go check them out.
Excellent stuff. Right, on with the show.
Welcome to the MMA Fan Podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Stu and Blake.
Hello and welcome to the MMA Fan Podcast. Why are you laughing? I didn't do the jazz hands.
No, you did this really long pause and then like a weird intake of breath. And I was like, you paused for so long. I was like, should I introduce it? You paused for such a long time.
Oh, dear. Welcome to the MMA Fan Podcast. Anyway, that voice you heard there taking the piss out of me right from the get-go is Blake Harrison. I'm Stu Whiffin. We'll be your host. But more importantly, we've got an ace guest, right?
Oh my God, we're so lucky to have him so soon after such a big win. We have Paul Craig on the show after his amazing performance at UFC 263, where he, anyone that watches it will see, I showed my wife this the other day. She was kind of watching it through her eye, through her hands. She watches everything through her eyes. Most humans watch things through their eyes, but she was watching it through her hands. She could barely watch it. I mean, Paul Craig dislocating Jamal Hill's elbow. Yeah. It looked broken. It looked like it just snapped with a vicious armbar in the first round of, I think, was it the opening fight of UFC 263?
Yeah,
I can't remember if it opened the main card, but I mean, what an amazing fight. And he's technically on a 4-fight win streak with a draw with Shogun thrown in there, but I think of it as a 5-fight win streak, because if anyone remembers that first fight with Shogun Hua, it was a draw in Brazil. Yeah. The judging was suspect. I mean, he's flying high at the moment. Scotland's Paul Craig on what I would consider to be a 5-fight win streak after an amazing performance. We're lucky to have him on the show.
And he's an absolute diamond. He really is. We have such a lovely chat and we get a real insight into Paul Craig, human being. And, we really find out a lot about, you know, who he is outside of the octagon.
Let's just get on with it. They're bored of listening to us speak. Let's bring on Paul Craig.
Sorry to interrupt this episode. We've just got to tell you all about our new sponsor, Feel Supreme. They're a nationally recognized brand who offer only the very highest quality of natural supplements. Their extensive range includes a range of medicinal mushrooms, nootropics, anti-aging products, gut support products, green powders, vitamins, and much more.
Yep, they've worked with fighters from all the top promotions, including UFC, Bellator, Brave, and Cage Warriors, with a solid reputation of providing results. So check them out on Instagram, which is @feel_supreme, or their website, www.philsupreme.co.uk, and make sure you use the code MMAFAN for a cool 15% off your first order. Don't say we don't spoil you.
Back to the podcast.
Paul, how's it going?
Yeah, guys.
No, Paul, it's really lovely to talk to you. Thanks for taking time out of your day to chat to us, mate.
No, it's an absolute pleasure, man. I'm a fan of these guys, man. You're doing it's good to see an MMA podcast based in the UK. And it's just, it's fans, it's proper fans, and it's proper fans. So what you're doing is great, man. I love you.
Oh, that's really kind of you, mate. Thank you very much for saying that. So are you quarantining at the moment? Is that what's going on? Because you've come back from Vegas.
Yep. So it was a 10 days quarantine. So first 2 days, I have to do a test day two and then day eight, which is today. So I need to do my test today. But the government does a 5-day release thing. So you pay an extra £100 and you can go into general population again. So it was a no-brainer. And that was so I could go and meet some of my friends and have a few beers. So that was the weekend there. So I'm just glad to be back to normality. But as you're saying that, see the US is normal. The US is just running everything like there's no COVID. The guys aren't wearing masks. All pubs, all nightclubs are open. Like, I was in a nightclub, which I've not been in probably about 5 years. Like, I'm talking, you couldn't move in this nightclub. The place was packed. Yeah. And there's me in the middle of the dance floor swigging bottles of whiskey. Wow.
But I mean, obviously they're doing so well with it. I mean, they haven't exactly got the highest COVID death rate, I think they've got, is it, in America? So, you know, they clearly know what they're doing, don't they? So, yeah.
I think we'll thin the American population.
Oh, Jesus. That's, let's move on to happier subjects. But you know what? Speaking about that quarantining thing, I did a job in Kiev a little while back, and I did the same thing. You did the 2-day test, then you paid extra to do the 5-day test so you could go into general population, but you've still got to do your day 8 test.
Yep.
Did my 5-day test into general population, and on day 7, I got a text from NHS saying, you've been in contact with someone from COVID. You have to isolate. So I was out for a day. I was out for 1 day. And it turned out that someone on the flight from Kiev had tested positive for COVID. So even though I knew I didn't have it, I'd done multiple tests and all that stuff. Because there was other people on the crew and the cast that all got the same message. And we were like, oh, this is absolutely typical that we've got our day to cut. We can now go out. Been out for 1 day, and then you have to go back and complete your isolation anyway because someone on the flight tested positive.
I know that was I'd come back and I'd pick my daughter up from the childminder, and I'd said that to her because we were tested every single day when we were in Arizona. Every single day we had to get tested, and then a test to get back on the flight, and then as you're saying about the 2 days, 8 days. So I come back to pick up my daughter from the childminder. So I was pretty confident that I didn't have it. Come back for the childminder saying, oh, one of the kids is away to get tested. And I was like, are you winding me up, man? I've been in the state. I've been doing what I want, and then I come back to the UK and I catch it. So it turns out it wasn't. But it's a scary time we're in at the moment, man. So it's glad I'm glad to be traveling the world. Within the last year, you know, people are like, this is a dark side of COVID. Like, people are losing members of family. People are losing businesses. I really can't complain because I ended up touring half the world last year. You know, I was in Milan, I was in Las Vegas, in Abu Dhabi, in Warsaw and Poland. So I really can't complain whenever there's so much bad stuff happening in the world, man. So I'm in a good place. What about you guys? How do you enjoy the old lockdown?
Yeah, well, I mean, work-wise for me, it's been pretty rubbish, but it's meant that I've started this. So, you know, peaks and troughs. No, but genuinely, and I know it sounds weird, there's little silver linings to everything, and there's people out there that have had such an awful time either with employment or losing family members, and just, you know, mental health obviously has suffered massively as well. And these are huge things. And, you know, it's easy for someone in our positions to say that we found a silver lining in it. It's obviously not for everyone when they're dealing with far bigger issues than we are. And, you know, with work for you, you've been able to carry on because the UFC's done a great job of being able to put safe events on for fighters and production crew and all that. And I've done a little bit of work more recently. But But yeah, it's had its ups and downs. But you can't really complain when I've been able to start something like this up, and I'm talking to people that, you know, I'm a fan of yours, and we've had so many fighters on now. We've been so fortunate to get great fighters on that we, you know, watch from, because we are, as you said earlier, we're just fans. We're not, you know, I've not really got any contact with the sport, other than like every now and again hitting pads with someone that's like, oh, I've got Stu in or Blake in today. This is going to be an easy one because they'll get tired in 5 minutes. And that's like our contact with the sport, other than just being massive fans of it. So to be able to kind of set up something like this during what is, you know, a very difficult time has really been massive for me. I genuinely think it's helped me. Sorry, Stu, I keep rambling on. I'll let you talk in a minute. But but genuinely, like, and we're getting a little bit deep, but I think doing this has massively helped me mentally, because, you know, work has been hard to come by. Like, I don't know how much you know about like acting and stuff, but there's a lot of self-tapes now. So whereas beforehand I might go into an audition and be competing against 10 to 15 other people for a role, now they're like, oh, we'll just send it out to people online and they can tape at home. So I've got like my wife reading the lines off camera while my phone's set up on a tripod and everything. And then you send it in and you don't know whether you're doing it right, because you're not the director. The director might have a completely different idea of what the character should be. So normally you'd be in the room and they'd go, oh, that's great, Blake, but I saw it more like this. And then you can change it and do it. And that's what acting's about. But in this situation, you just do it, hope for the best. But you know that it's probably gone out to 40 other people. So you're so much more competition for probably less jobs, because there's still smaller jobs that aren't starting up with like theatres particularly and stuff like that with the pandemic. So doing this has given me something else to focus on, you know, and it's been a real, real help to me.
It's definitely a way forward, I think, see, for like podcasts and putting yourself out there and interacting with fans and interacting with as many people as you possibly can. I think podcasts within the last 10 years have been a step forward and a breath of fresh air. Going back for like when we were kids, it was a radio, you know, and you had like the proper disc jockeys who had these feet boys. Let's go. Now we're actually getting real. But it's now we're getting real people who are telling their experiences, man. And I think it's beautiful. We've seen that. I love seeing guys starting podcasts, and I love hearing about positive successes in it. Yeah. So he's doing that, as I said. He's doing amazing.
Yeah. I just want to say, like, for my work, I run a nightclub, and it's obviously been shut for, you know, a long time now. And I was really excited to ask you about your recent fight and your career. Now I just want to know what it felt like to be shoulder to shoulder in a packed nightclub swigging whiskey. That sounds way more exciting for me.
It's funny, like, so I don't have many, like, star-studded moments, you know, where I'm rubbing shoulders with other athletes or any of that kind of stuff. But in this nightclub, there's me, there's Idril Adesanya, there's Leon Edwards, there's Jimmy Manoa, who I've trained with, and I see him as quite a friendly guy, and then we're quite close. Fast forward a couple of hours, and then there's me and Jimmy Manoa absolutely steaming drunk with this bottle of whiskey. Like, we were just giving his bottles of proper 12 whiskey. Now, I enjoy drinking whiskey. Like, I really do enjoy it, and I enjoy it neat. Not out of a bottle and not swimming. So my night came to a crashing end after that fight. I got a phone call from, I woke up the next morning, Sunday morning, woke up like, how did I get home? And my coach, Brian, he's like, I had to come and get you. And I was like, where was I? And he was like, lying in the middle of the street. And I said, what? He said, the UFC phoned him and said, Brian, you're going to have to come and get Paul. He's lying in the middle of the street. And a limousine just pulled up and kicked him out. So this is like, I thought, I've made it. That's my life complete. I have actually been kicked out of a limousine in the middle of a sidewalk, and it's taken three people to get me to my bed. So that's my rock and roll story.
Wow. Well, that's it. You've made it now. There's nothing left to do in life. You've been kicked out of a limo.
I know that's exactly it. But it's like, so it was just a surreal night. Ended up in this penthouse, and it was like a proper American moment, you know, the DJ's on in the corner, there's bottles of champagne just getting popped, and everybody's just partying. And then there's me just like bewildered at this point, just still this bottle of whiskey. I had probably about two bottles of whiskey myself, and straight whiskey is rocket fuel. So that's how my night came to a crashing end. And then we got back up in the Sunday morning and we did it all again.
Oh, wow. Well, you had a lot to celebrate because it was a huge win on a huge, huge card. And I mean, normally we'd start this podcast by going, Paul, tell us how you got into MMA and all this stuff. But the moment is all about that fight at UFC 263. And I think what happened to Jamal Hill's arm as well was a big, big part of that. And the fact that it happened in the first round. Can you tell us how that stoppage felt for you? Because there has been a few noises made about the ref and the stoppage being late and stuff like that. How did you feel about it?
So first and foremost, this is a long time coming. Like I've been training in the UFC for 4 years. 4 years I've been grafting and I've been fighting these unbeaten fighters and I've not really had my, you know, I've worked my way up progressing, you know. I believe I beat Shogun Hua the first time.
I saw it. You definitely did. Like,
I absolutely lit him up, man. And took that in like 7 days' notice. It stitches my eyes. So I'd worked really hard to get to this point and I feel like I've paid my dues. And then it came to the point where I'm fighting a guy who's beat OSP and beat him convincingly. And then he's only other two fights prior to that in the UFC. When you're comparing my 11 fights that I've had in the UFC. So I just feel my journey was a little bit harder than his. I've faced a lot of like stone walls where I've had to try and push through these. I've been knocked out twice, once in my hometown and then once in America. So I believe I've had a really tough journey to this point, whereas I don't think Jamal has. Jamal's been the hammer, never ever been the nail. I've been the nail many a times and I've came back for being the nail. So when we got offered this fight way back in December, we snapped the hand off it because his jiu-jitsu hadn't been tested. And we knew our jiu-jitsu is, if it's not one of the best in the division, it's up there, definitely up there. So once it came to our fight, it was booked for March and then it was cancelled due to COVID. Jamal had caught COVID. It was then moved 3 months later. So that was 6 months doing the exact same thing every single day, working the same positions, the same movement patterns, all this kind of stuff. And it's like drillers make killers, the Bruce Lee line where it's like, fear the man that does one kick 1,000 times and it's about being repetitive and doing the same thing over and over again. And it just showed in the fight. So when we took up that octagon and I'm stepping forward and I fling my jab and then I clinch with him, I just felt a lot stronger than him. And it's like, at that moment, you feel him and you're like, oh, this is going to go my way. I love being the hammer. And then it was a case of just dragging him in the mat and working on what I've worked on before. And we've seen it in when I fought Kennedy and Chukwu, just the exact same setup, the mere lock to throw him off and then to look for that triangle. I used the same setup again in my fourth fight in London against Magomedov and Kalayev. So it's a move that it's my bread and butter. So when I fired that up and the transitions were there, when it came to passing that arm across, like I can create a lot of pressure.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
On that, what is it? The give me a lever and a place to stand and I'll move there if I leave her long enough. And that's exactly what this was like. Pushed it across and then the arm went. At that time, I thought the arm had snapped. I didn't realise the elbow had just dislocated and came out, but it was flat on my belt like a bit of spaghetti. So I go to the referee and I'm like, it's broke, right? But at that point, you need to remember, that referee doesn't understand Scottish. And especially like a hyper-Scottish guy who's like, ah! So the guys just probably think this is a war crime. So I can't blame the referee because it's such a tough sport. To be a referee in any sport, be it football or be it American football, baseball, now there's times where human error is going to come in and there's going to be that element of he's made a mistake. But in our sport, when he makes a mistake, it's pretty catastrophic sometimes. Mm. It results in maybe somebody getting knocked out or more elbows getting landed or more headshots getting struck. But for this point, it was the broken arm. And then once I'd actually realised that, I was like, right, I just need to finish this fight. I'm not going to win with a submission and I just need to stop the fight. So it was just a case of dropping some punches and dropping some elbows until the referee stepped in. But in that moment, the referee, I don't like blaming the referee because the opponent said as well, Jamal could have tapped at any point and said, listen, I've had enough. But Jamal was one of these guys who was going out in the shield, whereas he posts up and I've got the triangle locked in and he starts dropping these absolute bombs to my face. So if I'm a referee, I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, right, he's fine. He's safe. He's still trying to fight. He's still active. So he put all the blame on the referee. I find it very difficult. But for me, an amazing win and an amazing opportunity to push me on in my career.
Yeah, there was a bit of animosity before the fight as well. And I remember watching the embedded and he seemed to come over to you and you were just, again, editing can happen and all that stuff, but you just seemed to be standing there and he's come over to you and all of a sudden it starts flaring up into a proper argument that seemed like it was started by him.
Yep.
And it was just bizarre. So, like, I think most fans were watching that going, what's happened? What's he said? What's going on? And then I think Jamal Hill says that it's personal before the fight and stuff. Yep. So from your perspective, can you tell us what was going on or what happened there, why it was personal for him and stuff?
So we have a media day, we call it, and basically it's a day where all the fighters are going back and forward, and if you're on the main card or somebody wants to speak to you, this is your day to speak to the media. And you do stuff like you take pictures because they've all got the new Venom gear, so you have to take new promotional pictures, you have to test out all your gear. So there's this day where it's basically, it's a horrible day because you're getting shipped, you're getting pushed from pillar to post, you're talking to different people. And you're still making weight because you're still actively trying to make a weight. So I was still trying to cut like 5 kilograms at this point. So I'm getting ready to sign posters. They do these big, massive posters. You sign them and then they pull the next one. And I think it's something like 500 posters you've got to sign. So I'm in the process of doing this. And Jamal comes over to me and he's like, who's your dealer? Now, I couldn't think out what it was he was trying to say, like my dealer. And I'm quite taken aback by this. And he's like, yeah, because then he starts saying, like, I must be on drugs, think I'm going to beat him and all this kind of stuff. At that point, I realised this guy's more emotional than I thought he was. He had to come up to me and he had to kind of measure himself up for me. So I was cool, calm and collected. Like, at this point, I'm in no interest to fight. We've scheduled to book the fight on Saturday. And then all of a sudden, he then kind of steps up to me. And then the place just kind of erupts and people are grabbing each other. I'm trying to, the UFC corner guys are trying to get involved. The bouncers are trying to get involved. And then they have to start pulling him away. And then that then resulted in us having security guards. So we had 2 security guards with us all the time. Jamal had this big muscle dude, you know, like where his ears and traps. So his neck was like this. He'd this mountain of a guy, right? And they gave me the smallest, skinniest guy there was. Like, he was literally lucky if he was like 5'4". Like, I don't know if he's like a trained killer or something, and his hands are deadly weapons. But if 2 guys, like me and Jamal, are going to town, this guy's doing nothing. And I go up to the UFC and I said, hey, why did I get the wee guy and he gets the big guy? And then, we know you're no kicking off. We know he is kicking off. So I see this as a job, and I see this, that's the way I run it. I run it as a business. I run it like, if I'm not out training, then I'm not making money. And the only way I can make money is if I put in the right hours. It's the same as any business. If you don't put in the hours, you don't make the money. So every morning I get up at my 6 a.m, do my 6 a.m. session. Sorry about this. Decline.
That's
sorry.
Right.
So if I'm not putting in the hours, then I'm not going to progress. Whereas whereas Jamal's at the process where he's still trying to find his feet. And I was there going back 4 years ago where I didn't know where I fitted in the UFC. I wasn't sure if I belonged there. And it took me a long time. I think Jamal was just at that point there. And I do believe he's going to go on and he's going to be a title contender, but just I had his number. And I believe that anybody I come up against, I'm going to have their number. That then, the whole emotion thing was then highlighted to me at the end of the fight, and it was the reason he was as emotional as he was is he felt I was disrespecting him and my fans were disrespecting him. He had some messages and they were racial, and like there's nobody condones that at all in this sport. And that's what I said. I was like, if these people are claiming that my fans are no fans of mine, like MMA is one of these sports where it doesn't matter what colour, creed, sex you are, who you fancy and that kind of stuff, it doesn't matter. It's just about two guys going to war, basically. And I find it difficult and I find it upsetting that he has to go through that kind of stuff. And especially in this day and age, and especially with what has happened recently, it's just, I didn't think people would just attack somebody for that reason, and that's what they were doing. So I understand why it was personal to him, but I didn't realise that until after my fight. And I apologised to him, and as I said, it's not my fault. I can't control what people's narrative is out there in the social media, but as I said, they're no fans of mine.
Well, I mean, that's just so unfortunate to be happening, and yeah. I mean, it's awful for him and anyone to have to deal with that kind of stuff, but that's awful as well, people saying that they're in some way connected or representing you by being your fans and using that kind of rhetoric and language that, you know, you would never condone. And
absolutely horrible. Absolutely horrible.
One thing I did see was that you wore the rainbow coloured name on the shorts. I mean, you just mentioned there that, you know, as far as you're concerned, MMA is for absolutely everyone. And I think one of the probably most, from the outside looking in as a fan, when you see, we spoke about, me and Stu spoke about it recently. When it comes to a lot of the trash talk, unless you've got someone like Colby Covington or someone like that, that is pushing the envelope in certain areas to put it in a polite way, then most of the kind of very disrespectful things that you get can be sometimes bordering on the homophobic. And I was really, really pleased to see that yourself, and I think Hill did it as well, to his credit.
Had the
rainbow coloured shorts on, and I wasn't necessarily paying a huge amount of attention to too much of it throughout the night, but I think more people didn't do it than did do it. So I think credit to you for going out there and doing that as well, and to try and put it out there that, you know, as you say, MMA is for everyone. It doesn't matter about race, sexuality, any of that stuff. If you're into martial arts and you want to watch it or get involved in it, then it's for you. And I just wanted to say credit to you for doing that. Was that an easy decision to make because there was lots of people not doing it? Or
it's for every day in the week, you know. If it can raise just that little bit of awareness, I'm not saying like I'm changing the world like at all. Because I wore that, I'm changing lives. I'm not. What I'm just trying to say is, like, it doesn't matter what you are. Mm. Just be happy in your own skin. And I think this is an ideal time to have it seen, you know, when people are wearing the jackets and it's all over the TV, it's in America, worldwide. So I think it's a great opportunity. And for me, it was like a no-brainer. We've got, I train with a lot of guys and I train with a lot of girls who they fall into these brackets, and to represent them is an honour.
Absolutely. You mentioned something earlier when you stood there, when you said you were standing there in the nightclub just thinking, wow, what's going on here? And then you mentioned not that long ago as well that you'd been questioning your place in the UFC in the past as well. With that in mind, do you think that's sort of like an imposter syndrome? And how have you sort of learned to sort of manage that?
So when I first started my career, I was 25. I was round about the age of 25, and it was easy. MMA for me was very, very easy. I beat everybody in the first round. Had ended up going to be Bama, who was like the top organisation in the UK at the time. Cage Warriors were taking a hiatus at that moment, so Bama had stepped up, filled that mantle. And I had ended up fighting a top prospect in Carol Moore, ended up beating him. He went on to be the Cage Warriors light heavyweight champion and the heavyweight champion. So a proper stud. And then I then fought the Bama champion and I beat him in one round as well. So I had this nice, easy journey. There was nothing stood in my way. And then we get a phone call for the UFC and I accepted that. We went away to California and the same again, second round submission, had beat an unbeaten prospect in Henrique da Silva, who had knocked out quite a lot of his opponents. So when I got to the top, which was UFC and beating an unbeaten opponent, then what's next for you? You think you're the man, like, oh, this is easy. I've completed this game. But what I didn't realise was I didn't have enough ring experience and I didn't have enough time in the actual training. And from that, I ended up picking up two losses, going up against Tyson Pedro, who beat me in the first round in Vegas. Took it really bad then. And that's when you kind of, your doubt starts to wobble. You know, you don't believe you should be there. Is this right for me? And then I then went and fought in Glasgow straight after it just because I wanted to rectify that loss. But mentally, I wasn't ready. Like, I was probably the lowest I've ever been in my life. And it's hard, you know, we speak about mental health nowadays. And at that point, I didn't want to speak about it because I didn't want to look weak to any of my friends and family. Because I'm in a sport where it's quite a tough guy sport. And we like to pretend we're tough guys. So I had nobody to speak to. And I then went on and fought in Glasgow. Ended up getting knocked out, just sheer fear. There was nothing else than being absolutely terrified of getting beat again, which resulted in me getting beat. Coming to the last fight in my contract, and it's that point where you're like, that's it, game over. I am not going to be a UFC fighter. Everything I've worked for is now just out the window. And I remember walking out in London, my last fight in my contract, fighting this unbeaten Russian who they were tipping as the next Khabib. And that was the kind of point where I was like, it's all or nothing. Either go 100% and give it my all in this fight, or I just give up and just fade off into the sunset and never be an MMA fighter again. And that was the kind of, you know, the phoenix rising through the ashes. And I took nothing but an absolute pacing for 15 minutes. Like for the vast majority of the time, he broke my rib, had busted my nose, had a hole in my chin. But it was one of these phoenix rising through the ashes, and I absolutely pushed everything I had in that to get that last second submission. Once I got that submission, there was this, right, I need to totally change everything I'm doing. I need to change how my training's going. I need to change my attitude. And then that's when I started to find a bit of success, you know. But I genuinely believed that it was going to be a game over for me. And at that point, I wouldn't have went anywhere else. I wouldn't have went to a lesser promotion like some European or some top US. I wouldn't have done it. I would have just said, no, it's game over. And prior to that fight, I'd given up my job. I was a high school teacher and I'd done that for probably about 7 years up to that point. And, you know, to pass up a job Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, where you're getting a nice regular income every single month and the bills are getting paid, to pass up that job to then go and become an MMA fighter where you don't know where your next buck's coming from, put a lot of pressure on myself and a lot of pressure on my family. But pushing to that fourth fight in that contract that then pushed me on to be an MMA fighter. Started putting in more hours in the stand-up, started putting more time into my development as conditioning. And then I seen it as a whole package. So it was a conditioning, it was a rehabilitation through the yoga, through the massage, through the stretching, through all the accessory work. And then it was, as I said, the nutrition to try and push me on to that next level. And if you see what I was when I first started the UFC, physically wise and mentally wise to what I am now, well, the two guys are night and day.
There's like quite a lot to unpack there. And sticking to the Ankalaev fight, because I wanted to ask you about that, because as you pointed out, it was, you were on a 4-fight contract. That was your last fight. You were on a 2-fight losing streak. And during that fight, I mean, firstly, I have to say, like, style-wise, if you haven't watched your fight against Dan Kalaev, in comparison to your fights, some of your more recent fights where you're winning by submission in the first round, it's like watching a different fighter, like, and not even in a negative way, because, you know, you're throwing a lot of kicks, you're throwing some spins, you're throwing something, and, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily think of you in that way. And I was watching it go, and I remember watching the fight originally and just being like, oh my God, 1 second to go and he's pulled it off. This is amazing. But I forgot about just like stylistically, you seemed very different.
Yep.
But can you talk us through you've talked about the emotions leading up to the fight. I'm assuming you were aware that despite the fact that I think you were doing all right in that fight, judges' scorecards probably had it for Ankalaev.
Yep.
And you are probably thinking in that last round, he's on top of you. He's known as being like one of these kind of like Dagestani wrestling types. And that clock is running down and running down. And you're not just running down to the end of the fight and potentially a loss. You're running down to, this is the end of my UFC career. And as you've just mentioned, maybe the end of your MMA career. Can you talk about the emotions going through your head, if there were any at all, other than just avoid this punch and try and throw up a triangle? Or what was going on in your brain?
Yep, I was definitely in the moment. The whole experience, like from walking out from start to finish of that fight, was an emotional roller coaster. I remember walking out and hearing my walkout music and I nearly cried. Like, there was that much emotion because, like, I know, as I said, it's to be this tough guy or I need to be, but at that exact moment, I wanted nothing more than to cry because there was so much pressure on me. I had taken my team in this journey and I had so many people relying on me. And as I was saying about the family, and then now going back to look at teaching with my tail between my leg as if I failed. And it shouldn't be like that. It shouldn't be that I failed. It should be I took an opportunity and I succeeded. I did succeed. And I remember that last 10 seconds, and you know, you hear the wood banging against the table, and I can hear John Gooden, and I can hear
Dan Hardy,
and I can hear them because I'm so close to them, and you can hear everything. And because you're in this point of fight or flight, everything is in slow motion. And I was like, and I remember just thinking about my kids and thinking, my oldest daughter has to go to school on Monday morning, and everybody's going to say to you, your dad's lost, and your dad get beat up for 15 minutes, and your dad is more in the UFC. And I was like, it's all or nothing now. And I just timed that shot, flung it up, and I willed absolutely every bit of muscle I had in my leg, every bit of power, just to squeeze as tight as I could and finish this guy. And it worked. And it's always going to be one of the greatest moments in my life because, as I said, at that moment, that is the phoenix rising from the ashes. And I remember standing up. I could barely stand. And my teammate, Chris Bungard, had come over the cage and jumped me for the back and was giving me this hug. Now, at this point, I didn't realise what had happened. I was just so emotional. He jumped to my back and I thought I was getting jumped off the cornerman. I thought I was getting jumped off his cornerman. And I'm turning around, you can see the fear in my eyes. And I remember after the fight, you know, we go out and my coaches give me a speech after every fight, and it's very motivational. And I remember just going out to the toilets and just crying.
Wow.
Because I had to let everything out because everything was just on top of me. I remember just going out of the toilets, still in my UFC gear, still with a hole in my chin, broken ribs, and just had a good cry at myself and just released all that emotion, and then totally changed me. And life's about experiences, isn't it? If we can learn anything, it's about experiencing and what you do in the tough times.
One of the experiences that we like to ask fighters, Paul, when they come on this podcast, is their kind of process in those moments before you get the shout that you're up and you've got to make that walk out to the octagon. We've had so many different kind of people. Some say they sleep, which seems crazy. And some people say, you know, they just do a bit of pad work. What's your process before you get that call to walk out?
It's quite a tough process because what I try to do is I try and mimic it as best as I possibly can. Every training session I go into, I'll have the same warm-up. I'll do the same breathing technique and I'll do the same routine as best as I possibly can. So it makes it less alien for me. So rather than doing something that's not normal to me, like, oh, I do this for a fight and only a fight, because then it become I only get to experience it once every couple of months. So what I try and do is I try and desensitize myself to the emotions. So do it every training session, listen to crowds. So that was the first time with crowds in nearly a year and a half. So it was a way back in November in Brazil, the last time we had a crowd. So it was about listening to the crowd. I use a lot of visualization. So not just being in the octagon, visualizing myself being in there, but that walk. That walk's one of the toughest things you're ever going to have to do, because you've got this camera in your eyes blinding you. And then you've got to then go and get your checks. And I visualize it all. And you visualize the fans booing. You visualize the fans cheering. And it all comes down to that desensitization. And then it's about hitting pads and getting that first wind out, expelling all that energy and hearing that noise of that pad crack, because that's one of the things that, like, right, be ready. If that pad isn't making the right noise, and it sounds silly, but if that pad isn't making that right noise, then we're only ready. We need to take a wee bit longer to hit that pad to get sat, you know, that sweet noise, and it's a good slow mac. Then it's hand wrapping time. And I'll always wear a red bracelet around my wrist. And this red bracelet, it's just a bit of string, and it's all the blood, all the sweat, and all the tears in that full camp goes into this bracelet. And the only time that bracelet comes off is after the fight, when you cut off the wraps, and it's inside the wraps, and I'll put a brand new one off on every single fight I do. So that's quite symbolic for me. I'll take a picture of my family, my two daughters and my partner, and I'll put it inside my glove. It'll be wrapped up. And that's my ritual. And then it's game time. And I do this thing, and not a lot of people know I do it, because you won't be able to hear it. And I hum, and I reverberate my teeth. And it sort of resets me, getting ready to go. But I hum into my teeth so that that the noise is what I experience walking out there. And it's just that hum. It sounds silly, but that's the first thing I've ever told him about.
That's amazing. But I mean, the thing that's blown me away the most is you've got a picture of your family in the glove.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know whether that would be allowed. Is that not like a foreign object or something like that?
It's only a wee tiny bit of paper, yeah. And it goes in there, and it's all taped up. The tape's harder than the actual picture. I've actually had the picture. I was in a state where they wouldn't let me put it in. I think it was Vegas. It was in Vegas, and the boxing commission was like Minneapolis or somewhere like that. That was the sanction commission, and they had said, no, you're not allowed in. Whereas everybody, every other state, every other place I've been has allowed me, and I had to put it inside my cup just so the family. And it's just honestly, it's a wee tiny picture. And
you don't want to get any paper cuts down there, though, mate.
No, you don't. Quick circumcision there. And what we'll do is, I've got one more picture left of that batch, and then we'll take new ones, and then we'll have a brand new picture. And they're all different pictures. They're just me and my kids, just in like a wee photo booth. And then there'll be brand new pictures for the next one. And the same again when it comes to songs. Excuse me. I'll use the same song three times. Three's my number. I've worked out, because when I used four, I lost. So I was like, three's my number, and I'll always have that song for three more times.
Wow.
That's amazing. I absolutely love that.
I mean, you mentioned when you was going in that last round and there was no crowd there, and you could hear John and Dan Hardy commentating. Like, talk a little bit more about what it was like fighting in empty arenas, and how much of, like, what you can, you know, what can you hear everything? I imagine, like, when there's a full crowd there, you're not hearing the commentators, and do you just at that point tune in to just your corner? I'm more interested in the kind of what it was like that first time you fight in an empty arena, just the complete difference of sonically.
This being an entertaining sport and being the crowd, we've always grown up with the crowd being there. So by the time we get to fighting in the Apex in Las Vegas, and there's no crowd and the place is empty, and the only thing you can really hear is like the commentators, and you can hear them. You can't hear word for word what they're saying. You can catch out maybe like two or three words. But what that means is when you're in the octagon, what you can hear is you can hear every single kick, every single punch. But you can also hear your corner that bit clearer. And because you're tuned into their voice, you can even hear them when it's noisy outside. So when the place is erupting, you can still hear your corner because your ears tuned to hear that dialect and your ears tuned to hear that the numbers are they like. So it'll be like, it'll tell you fling one, it'll tell you fling two, and we'll work specific numbers for that. So although you can hear people, it's very, very hard to pick people out. But going back to my very first time I fought in Glasgow, that crowd was overwhelming and it consumed me. It was just too emotional for me. I couldn't hear Bruce Buffer call my name. You know, I'm standing in the octagon across from my opponent and I could lip read Bruce Buffer saying Paul, Bear, Jew, Craig, but the noise and the love that I felt in Glasgow was something that's going to live with me the rest of my life. Even now, like the hairs in the back of my neck are standing up because it's an amazing experience to find your hometown.
Yeah.
And I'd love to rectify that again. And even in London, it was exactly the same. Like the love I felt from as being a UK fighter. Although Scotland's my home, I'm still a UK fighter and I still appreciate being part of that group. So the emotion and the love that you hear down in these places are amazing. And then you go to in Arizona and I'm getting booed. Like, and I'm going to Brazil and people are telling me they sort of got a chant and it's basically like, you're going to die. And so feeling the love in a country is nice, but feeling the hate just, you know, like it's great. It fuels you up because you want to turn them around. You start off with them hating you and then as you leave the octagon there, they love you. That's the sport we're in.
I was in Glasgow that night. I don't think I'd ever heard a crowd like that. It was absolutely ridiculous.
Ariel Harwani had named them like the best crowd of that year. Just they were so wild. And then I genuinely cannot believe that noise. And what made that even worse was all that love and all that respect that I had from the UK and from Scotland. And then I get knocked out and I can't even remember. I can't even remember because I remember that. That was pretty much the last thing I remember from that fight, and I lost like probably about an hour's worth of my time in that through the knockout. And I remember walking to the ambulance with my coach, and I kind of wake up, and it's like having a Sega, and somebody just keeps hitting reset, dink, dink, and it keeps going Sega resets. That was going through that's always happening in my head. I kept resetting, and I remember just walking to this ambulance, and I go to my coach and go, Brian, what happened? And he says, we're going to hospital. And then I go, did we win the fight? And he says, I'll tell you later. So we walk this wee bit further and then somebody hits that Sega and it resets again. Brian, where are we going? And he's like, going to the hospital. Did I win? And he was like, no, he didn't. Next time we're in the ambulance and I'm like, Brian, where are we? And he's like, you're going to hospital and you didn't win. And then reset again, boom. I hear the ambulance sirens going now this time. And I'm like, I kind of, Brian, what happened? And he's like, Paul, you get knocked out, you didn't win, and you're going to ask me this again. And then we end up going to the hospital, and everything's good. There's no long-term damage. There's nothing serious happened to me there. It was just this, the first time I'd ever experienced a knockout in this sort of reset, and then just Brian, my coach, like trying to manage that situation because we'd never been in it before. And he's trying to start sort of very diplomatic. No, we'll talk about it. You're absolutely fine. And then, but then he's like, nah, yeah. You get knocked out and you're going to ask me again, so don't bother. So it's a beautiful sport. And as you're saying, Glasgow, man, it's just a wild, wild place. And I love it. And I'd love the UFC to come back here this year. What I would love is another UK show within this side of the year, not to travel somewhere. And as we've spoke about, you know, COVID's coming to the end now, or it's more managed. And it'd be amazing to give the UK fans an event to go to.
Yeah.
And with no restrictions, you know, to sit with our friends, have a few beers and watch some amazing fights. So that's what I'd love to have before the December this year and have that. And like, I'm thinking somewhere like London, you know, London's a place where they love to go to. So that's where my fight against Ryan Spann before COVID hit was cancelled. And I'd love to go back there and do it.
Well, I mean, I think, I don't know if it's like fully confirmed yet or not, but I've heard there is a London card being planned. I mean, all these things, winky winky. I think that, yeah, as far as I'm aware, it's being planned. But obviously with the way that things keep happening and delaying of kind of getting completely back to normal and all that kind of stuff, I suppose nothing is set in stone. So yep, we'll have to wait and see. But one thing that
just before you move on there, so I can tell you I've got a fight for round about that time.
Oh, I was going to ask.
I can't tell you who it is, but I can tell you it's the biggest name I could possibly get. That's how good this fight is.
Ah, you can't do that.
You can't do that to us. So, all right.
I literally signed the contract this morning. The contract came in. Yeah. We'd been saying, listen, we want a top 10 opponent. Where we want either Johnny Walker, Krylov, or Volkanos. They were the guys who were shooting.
That's who I picked, because I mean, we do this thing after a big fight club where we're like, who do we think they should fight next? And I'm always worried that fighters might get pissed off about that, because I'm like, you've just had a weight cut and a fight, and now some idiot at home is going, fight this guy now, or something like that. But I picked exactly Krylov or Uzdemir, because I thought you got to go up the rankings. But Look, this is an audio medium, so there's no one can see you, Paul. So if you want to do anything visual to let me know what's going on,
I asked
for Uzdemir or Krylov. Is it one of those?
It's not one of those. Right? It's one name. Listen, it's a big name.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Big, big name. And this will put me in the top echelon of this division. I promise you, see when the name comes out, everybody's going to go,
I cannot wait.
Stand up for this fight.
See, what I'm hearing about this London card, again, we don't know what's happening, but yep, what I'm hearing about it is it sounds amazing. Everyone's on it, and it sounds so good.
What I've heard is just through the internet, and it was Till's potentially going to be the headliner.
And he's booked to fight Brunson, so I'm imagining it'd be Till Brunson.
That's what I think. But I can tell you, I'm not fighting five rounds, so that potentially means I'm not going to be co-main event, and I'm not going to be main event, but this guy I'm fighting, hey, it could even be a woman. I can't even tell you. This person I'm fighting is...
Is it Valentina Shevchenko? Are you fighting Valentina Shevchenko?
Does MD want to fight her?
Absolutely not.
Exactly. It could easily be main. Could easily be main event. I promise you that.
Wow.
It's beautiful. I signed the contract at 5:30 this morning, and I couldn't even go back to sleep because I was so excited.
Oh my god!
I want to tell everybody about it, and I can't. The UFC are like, they love to release the fights, and
yeah,
I wish I could tell you. But all that means is, hey, I'm playing a smart game here. All that means is you just have to get me back on. That's all that is.
That is all that means. Oh, I can think of two people that it might be. I don't know.
Listen,
oh, you know what? When we hang up, I'm going to ask you loads of questions. So we're going to say goodbye, but you need to stay on the line. Oh, man, that's so exciting. In terms of that, I mean, I think we are winding down towards the end.
Look
of the
Look at you trying
now,
to hurry up and get it all finished so you can ask him more questions.
Yeah, I do. All right, bye, Paul. Yeah, see you later, mate. Bye. Yeah, Paul, what's going on? What's happening,
that'll be
mate?
That'll be one of the moments where it's like the audio will just go on it. Like, I'll be telling you as an audio just...
Yeah.
We're going to use that sound of your teeth just buzzing as you do your little work.
Yeah.
I can't explain how excited I am for this fight. And as I said, like, we always want big fights, and we always want to be pushed up. And this is the guy that puts me in the mix.
Oh, so exciting.
It puts me in the mix for that title contention.
Oh man, I'm so excited for you.
I can see your faces are like this. Like,
the thing is, I was like, I think I know who it is, and then I saw a couple of other names because I pulled up the rankings. I was like, well, it might actually be this person instead. Oh, I'm so excited. But like when you're going into like a fight camp, people will now, especially after your last few wins, say, oh, Paul Craig, he's a real specialist. We've really got to be careful about the jiu-jitsu. Like, people know what to worry for. So when you're going into a camp, are you like, I expect my jiu-jitsu to be just so much better than everyone's that I'm just going to drill that thing so much that makes me, you know, the lethal fighter that I am? Or are you thinking, right, well, they're worried about the jiu-jitsu, so I need to make sure that I'm putting loads of extra time into my striking because they're going to be combating that? How do you balance your camp?
It's pretty, so the jiu-jitsu is my, that's what I love. I love that about the sport. Not that I don't love sparring, I don't love striking, I don't love hitting pads. I just love jiu-jitsu. It's pretty much two guys going up against each other, and it's flowy. There's loads of transitions, and I love the learning from that. Even though I got my black belt, I am still not the finished article in jiu-jitsu. So I don't see that as like a session. I don't see that as like, oh, I've done like six sessions a day because I've done an hour of jiu-jitsu, because I love that. What I work on is I work on where my coach believes I'm weak. So I'm actually a really good striker. And for a long time, I was trying to lean in to be a striker, but that's not what I am. I'm a jiu-jitsu guy. So what I need to do is lean into the jiu-jitsu, use my striking to get into be a jiu-jitsu guy. And I've kind of found that balance now. People are scared of my jiu-jitsu, so now I'm going to have to take the striking to the next level. I'm going to have to put more time into it, and that's what it's going to be for this camp. This camp is going to be heavily striking dominated. Loads of boxers, loads of amateur boxers for that sort of movement, so that when it comes to fight time, it's not going to be unnatural for me. And we've seen in the past, like the very first time I fought Shogun, he was so expecting me to shoot. That's why I did so good in the striking, because he expected me to shoot. So he was worried, and that's why he was caught with my hands. And then the second time when I fought him, he was so expecting me to come out guns blazing, ready to spar and ready to fling hands, that when the takedown was there, it was so much easier. So it's about constantly developing and not being this one-dimensional fighter. And I think I've shown that like within my fights. If I grab this person come September, and he feels like he's going to the ground, and I feel like I'm confident here, I'm going to drag him down and I'm going to take him into deep water. That's what I'm looking for. But he's very good at jiu-jitsu as well, and he's very, very good at striking. So this is my test.
Wow. Well, best of luck,
mate. I'm thinking of something to say, but my cogs are still turning now, trying to still work out who
he is. Genuinely, like, I can't say anymore, honestly. I'm going to trap myself up here. I'm just going to be like,
well, before we wrap up, one of the things that is really apparent is that you're a great talker, and obviously you said you was a teacher, so you know you're very good at presenting yourself. I mean, Blake mentioned it beforehand, you know, you're quite easy on the eye, like, and
I'm not gonna lie, I did say that. All right, I said he's a good looking lad. Stu took the mick out of me for it. I don't care. I think you're a good-looking lad, Paul, and I think it's okay for another man to say to another man that he's a good-looking man.
Well, listen, I look at guys and I'm like, how are you doing? You never know what's going to call the funny.
Yeah. So with that in mind, just looking way ahead into the future now, you know, post-fighting career, you know, is that something that you can, you know, you think about? Is that the media side of things something that, you know, that interests you? Like,
It definitely does interest me. But the only issue I've got is my actual Scottish accent's so thick. So I'm putting on, like, I have to slow everything down I'm saying so people understand me. It's not as bad when we're going from, like, within the UK to UK. It's easier. But when I'm going the UK to America, like, they cannot understand me. And they're like, get subtitles. The subtitles 90% of the stuff I do, just because it's so thick. So what I would need to do is I need to actively work on changing my accent. And then it then comes into this, like, do you go for that fake, either go for the fake Jared Butler one, you know the one who talks like this. It's like a poor man's, yeah, Sean Connery, where John has your fake accent and he talks you like this, or you go for the Begbie. Like, so, hey, what's happening, mate? So you need to kind of find this accent, and I genuinely would love to go into the world of presenting, acting, just expressing myself. But I hate listening to myself because I talk some amount of trash. Like, when I listen back, I'm like, ah, Paul, what did you say that for? Come on. And I get all embarrassed. So although I come across maybe to yourself as being articulate, I'm like, when I watch it back, I'm like, oh, stop talking, Paul. Stop it. So, no, I generally would like to do something like that. But who knows what the future brings for you in the world of MMA. It's a tough old sport. But I have said previously, my number's 35. Like, I don't want to do this well into my 40s. I don't want to be creeping up to 40 and still getting punched in the face for a living. I don't want my daughters to see that as the only thing I can do. I want my daughters to see that having a dream and getting to a point and then not going any further is all right. It's about knowing your limits, because it's a tough sport. And the last thing I want to leave the sport is with a couple of extra pounds in my pocket and a couple of brain cells missing. I don't want that. I want to be sharp. I want to be myself, because that's what makes us, that ability to talk, that ability to hold conversations. Whereas we all know boxers and we all know athletes who have taken too many headshots and you can see them starting to slow down. I don't want that to be me. So 35 is my number. And everybody keeps saying, Paul, stop saying that's your number. I'm like, no, that's my number. And I'm confident in myself that I can walk away from the sport. I can genuinely walk away from the sport and be happy with what I've done.
Yeah, and so you should be. I mean, you're on a great, great win streak at the moment. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's a 5-fight win streak, because that draw was not a draw with Shogun, that first one. And you got some really, clearly very exciting stuff coming your way, hopefully in a few months, maybe.
If everything goes well with the UK opening up, it should be London. It should be London.
Yeah.
But this fight's happened no matter what. As I said, I've signed that contract. We can push it back a month, 2 months. I'll even push this back a year. That's how good this is.
Wow. Well, Paul, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. We were really excited about having you on. And yeah, it's been brilliant. And you shouldn't worry about how you sound on things. I think you're incredibly articulate, and I don't think you'll look back on this interview at all and think that you should have stopped talking. I think you've been brilliant, mate. Thank you so much.
No, thanks for the time, man. I really appreciate it. And honestly, I appreciate what you're doing, man. You're bringing MMA into the UK, and I love it, because we're still way behind the US in regards to MMA coverage, but also MMA itself. And by you guys putting products out there, you're then bringing the next generation of young athletes into the world of MMA by inspiring them. So, guys, honestly, I appreciate everything you're doing for the sport.
Amazing.
No, thank you, mate. That's really kind. Thank you very much. We'll hang up now.
Don't
actually
anywhere.
Hang up. Tell us what's going on. But yes, we're hanging up with Paul Craig right now. Don't you dare hang up, Paul.
Well, there you go. Oh,
wow. Yeah, he just hung up. He didn't stay on the line and tell us some really exciting, brilliant news that we're now not allowed to tell people.
Yeah, just flicked us the V's and went. We got nothing. We've got nothing.
He told us nothing, Dana. He told us nothing. But I'm very excited for reasons completely unrelated to
weirdly
the
I
end
feel
of that
really
conversation.
Excited as well.
Yeah. Oh, this is actually a little bit torturous to do this to the listeners, isn't it?
Oh,
we know
yeah.
something you don't know.
I mean, everything else aside from obviously that that little carrot we're leaving dangling, what an absolute dude he was.
Oh, man. Yeah, just such a great, like, just, again, nice guy.
Yeah.
The way he was talking about the Jamahal Hill submission as well, and like it's like a bit of wet spaghetti or something like that. I mean, I can't imagine how that must feel. But then, I mean, also the horrible situation of, unfortunately, people probably stupidly thinking they're doing Paul some kind of favour by going into Jamal Hill's like Twitter or DMs or whatever it is and abusing him, racially abusing him, you know. I mean, that's just absolutely disgusting. And Paul was brilliant in kind of saying, you know, how much it's nothing to do with him. He does not condone it. And he's really feels for Jamal to have to have gone through that. That's awful. And that beef makes a lot more sense now as well. But what's a beautiful thing that I don't think we necessarily got into enough was that after all that, and after they'd had a chat about it, they're in the club drinking together.
Yeah.
You know, they're having a nice time. They're having a dance together and all that stuff. And that is, in so many ways, kind of symbolises where we as a planet should be going towards, you know. It's lovely.
And it's also something that, you know, the UFC and you know, other organisations should definitely kind of, you know, utilise clips of such moments really wisely as well, because there will always be people that, you know, get the wrong impression of what, you know, mixed martial artists are as people, and you know, and hate on the sport because they, you know, they see the brutality of it. And but, you know, when you see them shared moments of mutual respect and love, and, you know, and socializing, and, you know, it's their friends, you know, that's stuff that I think is a really good, you know, a really good kind of poster for mixed martial arts.
I couldn't agree more. That is, you're absolutely right. And then back to the interview, I love the fact that he's got a picture of his family and his gloves.
Imagine that. If he's not a terrifying looking dude as it is, he's just humming. What's that?
I'm gonna kill you. Oh man, no, but what a nice guy. I do think he's got a great career ahead of him.
Fucking
in
right,
terms of like broadcasting. No, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know what you're getting at, but I think that, you know, in terms of broadcasting and stuff, you know, I think he talks so well. I understand what he's saying about the accent. I'm sure Bisping had a thicker accent. Like, you probably watch him on the Ultimate Fighter that he was on. Was that the third series of the Ultimate Fighter? And I bet there's Americans out there that were like, what's he saying? And then he's kind of maybe slowed it down and cleaned up his accent a little bit, and now he's doing broadcasting. I'm sure Paul Craig could do a similar thing. But as you say, it's like, it's kind of who you are or whatever. Maybe you don't want to change that. But I think he could do it. I think he speaks incredibly well. And he does look nice. I'll say it. I can say it again.
Yep.
I think he's a good-looking man.
That's it. Three times in one day.
But yeah, no, it was a lovely, lovely chat, and there's some really exciting stuff going forward for Paul Craig and every one of his fans.
Absolutely. Right, we'll see you next time. In the meantime, go check out the back catalogue. If this is your first time listening to the MMA Fan Podcast, then you've missed some absolute crackers. You can hear us talking to, I mean, a who's who of cage warriors. We've just recently put out some spectacular specials there in the lead up to their trilogy events. You can hear us talking to fellow Scottish mixed martial artist Jojo Calderwood, Paddy Pimlet, Molly McCann. Who else?
We've had Arnold Allen. We've had, I mean, again, I don't know in what order everything goes up, but Arnold Allen is available. We've had Angela Hill recently.
Jack Shaw,
Brett Johns. God, the list goes on and on. We've done really well lately. We've had some really cracking guests on. And we've also got the Fight or Flight guests as well, and the kind of celebrity guests where it's been, you know, like Emily Head, Laura Checkley, James Arthur, Ben Shepherd, Lee Mack. And we're actually doing a few more records today. Don't know what order they'll go out in, but we've got some really exciting stuff coming your way on top of that as well.
Absolutely.
So,
there's one more. UFC world champion Alexander Volkanovski.
That featherweight guy, the one that's like, has the belt, that UFC world champion. Volkanovski. Yeah. I've heard of him.
And we've got some great episodes coming up. So the best thing to do there is just subscribe, and then and there's also going to be like our kind of pre and post fights, we've got our little gang with Brian Lacey and Scroobius Pip, and they're going to be back, and we're going to be looking ahead towards the Conor card when that drops soon. So yes, there'll be some more shows with them back on the microphones. But yeah, subscribe and you won't miss anything, and give us a follow on the socials as well, because we're on all the usual places. And we is out.
We're out. Bye, guys.
Sega resets, Sega resets, Sega resets.